How's it going, everybody, and welcome along to the second installment of On Cirag Ella with me, Ray Wingnut. You are listening to me via the incredible CuriousBroadcast.com. Curious Broadcast is a community web radio that aims to provide a cohesive, creative, and inclusive platform for arts, music, or anything that you want your community radio to be. So check out the website, make contact with Curious Broadcast, and get involved. So now, this is the second Cirag Ella, and coming up we have an exclusive interview with long-term hero, genuine broadcasting legend, and all-round rock man, Mr. David Fanning. So I'll be spraffing away with Dave about his career and about alternative music broadcasting and the future of music broadcasting in Ireland. Very important stuff. But first up, primed to be one of the best Irish albums this year, Jogging are about to release their second album entitled Take Courage, and it's coming out through the mighty Out on a Limb Records. So I met with Darren and Ronan from the band a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about the making of the new album. We'll take a couple of tracks as well, kicking off with this one. This one is called Dead Weight.
I'm
Broadcast.com, sitting in Whelan's with Darren and Ronan from Jogging.
How you doing?
How's it going, Ray?
Lads, thanks a million.
No problem at all.
Fierce excitement. What's going on with Jogging at the moment?
A lot.
Too much.
It's the new album. It's all about the new album.
Yeah.
So we recorded for 6 days in Sun Studios 3.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, just finished 3 weeks ago. Seems like months ago. And then, yeah, every day since has been, went straight to mixing and straight to mastering and working on artwork the whole time and trying to book the tour. Like, we literally haven't let up since we stepped out of the studio. We just kind of wanted to work to it. We did it last time with the last album, just like record it, release it, you get straight up. Like, I don't know how bands sit on albums for 9 months or 10 months. I just get really fed, not fed up with it, but
antsy.
Yeah, antsy. I think there's a kind of urgency in our music, and I think I'd like to reflect that in the other aspects of it, like just get it out there, push it away.
You like to stress yourself out.
Yeah, we do.
We definitely do.
So we kind of set this deadline of end of August to have it released by, and we were only like still writing songs in June.
Yeah, initially it was all to do with the Richters.
Their schedule,
because they had a few lined up, already lined up for the later in the year. So they were like, you either have to get in early or you're waiting until next year to do it. And that was just like, no chance we're going to do that.
It had been 2 years, like 2 years since the last one. I think I'm saying it kind of needs to kind of be, keep delivering. It's not kind of music you kind of sit back on and ruminate on and try and get loads of little production, you know, twinkles on. It's just like, it's pretty in your face. I think just keep, if you can keep pushing albums out every 2 years, that'll be, it'll kind of suit me.
I actually ended up recording with Chris Common, who was the drummer in These Arms Are Snakes, who were a band we're all massive fans of. And he's also like recorded all the bands like Native and Minus the Bear and Pelican and the drum tech on Mastodon albums and stuff. And Bats, it was Bats' idea. We completely robbed their idea. They got in touch with him and like he came over to do their album, which was recorded before our album, but I think it's just a much bigger scale project. There's just so much, you know, it's three guitarists and lots of vocals, and you know, it's twice as long as our album, so they're still like kind of mixing it. But they did it, as I said before, so we met up with him when he was over doing theirs. We were doing demos across the road, and he came over and was kind of like sniffing around. We'd kind of talked to Richter, we'd kind of had a list of producers that we, like a wish list, kind of working our way down through it. But most of it would entail us going to America or going somewhere else, and just cost us pile up, even just, you know, flights and keeping us fed for a few weeks. Whereas they're like, we can get someone to come here, it's just gonna, yeah, bring the cost way down. And he was working in Sun with Bats, and he loved the room. Like, I think Sun had got a bit of a bad reputation, but I think they've totally ripped it apart and put in a new drum room.
Where is Sun?
It's in Temple Lane Studios, so it's in Temple Bar. It's been there for years. We actually had recorded there years ago as Cold Spoons. But there's a couple of new guys running it, and they've totally revitalized the place. It's like the Chris, who owned like Red Room in Seattle, and like huge bands have recorded there. He's like, the drum room is like equally as good. He was just fascinated. Like, he's living in Portugal now, but he's planning to come over and work out of Sun as much as he can, if he can convince bands to come there. Just in terms of even Europe, he's like, this is an amazing room. It's an amazing place. Like, you know, more people should use this. So yeah, we should probably spread the word. It's good. There, it's really good to use. So he came, like, Bats did theirs in 12 days. Like, yeah, theirs was a lot more layered. We only had like six, just even kind of budget wise. So he was saying he's like, I've never done a record in 6 days. Some take 35. So he's like, okay, it's going to be like, yeah, pretty rough and raw. He'd heard our first album, he'd heard demos, and once we started playing, he's like, okay, I kind of get what you're going for. Like, you know, I'm going to try and capture this. Like, usually we do stuff a lot more mechanical, and it's all to a click. He's like, you guys, you know, you just kind of speed up at certain times, but you all stay together, and you end a song at a different speed you started, but it's like not going out of time. You all completely lock in, you have your own thing going on. So to try and make that more mechanical would, you know, not do justice to the music. He's like, I'm just going to try and make it sound as awesome as I can. And yeah, got an amazing drum sound. You really pushed Peter on, like, even drum performances. I kept coming in, because he's a drummer as well, he's like, that little, you know, one bass drum hit just lagged a bit, or that tiny little bit of late snare, like, geez, how did he catch that on his first listen? Like, how did he? And same, yeah, kind of pushed us a lot with vocals, because yeah, the kind of things that we'd be like, yeah, this is fine. He was like really, really pushed us to go again, just get the best possible take. Like, he totally set a fire under us in that way. Like, guitar and bass were more, you know, they're pretty much look after themselves, but stuff that's more physical and energized is like, you know, just, you gotta go for it again, really, you know, capture that. If you're going for this live raw feel, don't do it halfway, do it all the way. So yeah, we just blasted through for 6 days, used every single minute, like we were still doing vocals right up to the last, you know, just even other things were like, oh, we could try out when it got to like Monday night, and we're like, well, that's it, you know, it's then we do, like we stupidly thought we'd mix it in those 6 days, like, oh yeah, we'll, you know, we'll fly through it and mix it. But he was like, look, I've got a studio in Portugal, I can just mix it in Portugal, let's not rush it, let's do it well. So we used every second for those 6 days, and like, yeah, he was even a bit surprised himself. He was like, I can't believe we've got this whole album done in 6 days. And yeah, even listening back through it, he was like, I'm really proud, there's no filler on this album, like you've literally, like every song I put it on, I'm trying to remember what it is, it's like, oh, this one, he's like, it's like you should be really, I feel like I'm blowing my own trumpet now. This is him talking, this is not me talking. I think it's crap, he thinks it's no filler. But that was cool to hear as well. So he really wanted to get behind as well. He spent time, you know, in Portugal of his own time, mixing it, just trying to make it sound as good as it could. And then it was getting mastered in Washington, D.C. by TJ Lipple, who's in a band called Aloha. It was a really good band, and he's like mastered tons of bands from Lungfish to like MGMT, like pop bands and stuff. And we worked with him for the last album, and like we were really happy with what we got for that. So Chris even middleman, like, so we were trying to describe what we wanted as a master, we wouldn't have the language to, you know, engineer, so he kind of middleman that whole process as well. Even, you know, he wasn't even on the clock anymore, he just was like, okay, I want to, and then, you know, sending TJ mails about, you know, frequencies and brick walling and stuff, I don't even know what he was talking about. So that was really, yeah, it was really inspiring to kind of see someone kind of, yeah, he said that a few times. He's like, I really took off my producer hat and just put on my music fan hat, because like producer, I would be like, yeah, trying to make everything a bit more exact. He's like, you guys kind of remind me of why I got into music when I was a teenager, and the kind of bands I loved as a teenager. Maybe it just means we're really dated bands. But that was cool. Like, you know, he did really get behind. He was just sitting there like looking at his watch, going, yeah, you know, this is it. He kind of, you know, I think he kind of has taken a bit of sabbatical since he's left Seattle. So he seems really hungry to start doing it again.
I look around and all I can see
signed to release an album with them. It was in September 2009, and the end of that week, Out on a Limb also approached us. So if it had been the other way around, we could probably would have ended up on Out on a Limb. I remember we played some gigs with, like, it was Bats and IBC we played with on Saturday night, who were both Richard bands at the time, and we were the only non-Richard band playing. And the next day we were playing with And So Much From Affair, who weren't on Richard's stage, but they were kind of involved in the whole same scene. So the Richard lads were at, I think, both those gigs. And it was after that that they approached us and said, like, look, we'd love to... I think we only wanted to do an EP at this stage, because we were a very new band, but they were like, no, just wait and do an album next year. And then, I think later on that week, it was like the Friday and Saturday, we were playing with the Reading Manifesto in Galway and Cork. And it was with Cork that Kieran Ryan from Out on a Limb was there, and kind of came up afterwards, like, you know... Didn't say explicitly, but was like, looking... And we hadn't told anybody we'd signed a Richard, who was kind of still... But I had to say it to him, and he was like, ah, oh, so I kind of confessed there, and he was like, you know, all the way through, I was thinking... we're going to do it. So yeah, it was nice to know that was kind of there. And we when we were talking about doing this album with Richter, even back in April, they weren't keen to do vinyls because it's, you know, the turnover, it's, you know, it's much more expensive to do. So I kind of flew the idea of the way into Out on a Limb doing the vinyl edition, like, even when they weren't in any financial trouble or anything, when Richter was still going strong, they were kind of going, yeah, well, you know, if Out on a Limb want to do vinyl, we'll do the CD and digital. Like, there was kind of talks about doing that even well before they decided to close the label. So when they did close, it was all very kind of abrupt. I was just as we were going into record, it seemed like the logical kind of... we didn't just assume they'd want to do it, because it was obviously a lot more workload for them to take on if there wasn't Richter, you know, involved into, you know, Dublin. And I know they have, Out on a Limb have, you know, OND and Windings and Crane Smith and Elk and Rest all coming up, so I knew they were busy. But yeah, we talked to Kieran, I think we sent him a mail or something, and he was really keen to do it. But then again, we had to stick with the same deadline. He's like, we have such a tight schedule with our releases. Like, I think we were initially thinking, oh, it's great, we can kind of push it back a little bit, not be so rushed. But it was like, no, okay, we'll keep up to this kind of schedule set out of getting it to the end of August. And I'd played with Crane Smith before, who were on Out on a Limb, like, for a few years, so I'd kind of had dealt with Kieran and Richard and Albert, even when Albert was doing it, and just knew they were brilliant to deal with. Like, you just, yeah, anything you ask them, they just get back to you straight away, and they have an answer for everything, and they're very on top of things. Like, still loads of fun, but when they can actually are quite serious, then when it actually comes down to serious matters, they don't joke around. Like, it's not that Richard is, but I'd known that, you know, they were really, really dependable and great guy, and had such a good roster, and yeah, and a really good relationship with the bands. Like, everyone was friends, everyone was hanging out. It just seemed like a real good scene. Like, it was never a question. Because, yeah, it was, you know, even when Richard wind down, they were kind of saying, look, we could shop you out to different labels if you want. And I said, well, what's the point of that? Like, I'd rather go with someone I trust and know, and, you know, life's too short. And, yeah, I think they're going to have an amazing year in the next year. I think the line of albums they have come up, like the Rest one and the Winings one and Onzi and the Elk one and the Crane Smith, that I think they're all due in the next 6 or 7 months. It's just like, it's a really just... really strong, because they have been quiet. Like, admittedly, they've been quiet for the last few years. They know, like, they've done mostly just a couple of 7 inches and one or two albums that I think they knew themselves and kind of took the, you know, the foot off a bit. But now they're going full steam.
There was a bit of, maybe it was mourning or something like that, you know, while the album was being recorded. Wasn't there talk of collapsing guitarists and and just that dogged process of getting the album out and stuff like that? Or was that you just...
No, actually, it was true. We were still, like I was saying, we were still writing the songs right up to the last week. Not writing them, they'd all been written. They weren't rushed. Like, we were just arranging them and changing intros. And we've been, like, totally killing ourselves. Like, we were playing, practicing every single day, all day. Not really sleeping or eating properly. Just living in a shed. And
you
then just, like,
go home and re-listen to what you've been playing that day.
All day and go back.
Kind of trying to figure out if structures were right and stuff, and things should stop earlier or start sooner.
Like, the first song on the album, like, the intro, we put, like, we took it from another part of the song, put it at the intro like the day before, so it was just like, ah, we're still like, you know, it's good, it needs to be better, it needs to start with, like, all this kind of, we were still really just pushing ourselves for the whole week. And I think by the time we actually went straight from practice to loading into the, like, we straight from practice room to loading in all the gear, like all the really heavy gear, we hadn't gone and got dinner or anything, and I was looking a bit pale. And we'd been meeting Chris for, like, pretty much we'd met him with Bats, but, like, professionally meeting for the first time. We'd set up all the mics, set up all the things, and completely had forgotten getting lunch or dinner or anything, and kind of went to get, like, one drink with Chris, and Darren was just kind of, I thought he was being very quiet, gone very pale, and then just completely, eyes to back his head, glasses fell off, claps on the floor. All the bar staff started running around and like trying to call the ambulance and stuff. He got up, we're like, oh, it's okay. Tried to walk across, fell over again, completely collapsed, like eyes going in the back of his head. Chris had only met, so he's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, Jesus, does, you know, is he prone to seizures? Like, no, I've known you nearly 10 years. Like, I've never seen this. I've got him outside the door. And he's like, yeah, I'm kind of fine. Fell over again. Completely, like, five seconds doesn't seem like a long time, but it was like, holy shit. So they called the ambulance. The ambulance came along and they're like, yeah, your blood pressure's really low. Your blood sugar's really low. Yeah, and we just like, I was like, yeah, I still want to drive. I was like, no, it's fine. Let's just get him some food and let's record. So yeah, then I think I woke up next day not knowing if you were like, had some serious, you know, I was like, we have to do this. We have to, like, another 6 days. Another 6 days, and yeah. But yeah, I think a lot of people thought I was joking. I just put it up on Twitter that we collapsed and
before
he told his
own
family.
I thought you were joking. Jeez, I'm shocked.
No, not at all. I think, yeah, Chris was just like, what is with these weirdos? Like, I met them, and I think he'd had one bottle of beer, and he thought maybe he's real lightweight. He just had a bottle of beer and fell
well,
over.
That's it as well. I thought it was the beer because we'd been practicing so hard, I hadn't been drinking for about a month. And
one beer.
And it's just like, oh, gone. But no, it's the age-old thing of you need to eat, I think.
Yeah, you need to fuel your body.
Ambulance guys were like, you could go. You don't seem to have anything really wrong with you. You can go to the hospital if you want. I was like, I think I need to go get a burger. So I did.
You didn't have a near-death experience and God said, go forth and rock, Darren. Or something like that,
no, I just say, go get a burger.
when we sent the album from Mix to Master, there was about a 4 or 5 day delay. I'm like, what's going on with like TJ? And then you mail gun, a huge lightning storm. The whole electricity went out in our building for like the last few days while I was mastering your album. I was like, Jesus, this album, someone doesn't want it to happen.
It's doomed.
Rip your claps over here, your claps over there. The mastering studio is falling apart while it's being mastered. It's like really, yeah, it's going to wreck out everyone's stereo. You put it on, so it's going to blow up your stereo.
It's going to be cinematic. I'm fucking excited. Jeez, yeah. That's great.
Cool,
thanks
cool.
A million. We'll be right back.
That is amazing new stuff from Jogging, and thanks a million to the lads for talking to us. The album is coming out on August 24th on 12-inch and on digital through the amazing Out on a Limb Records. Next up, he's been the man on the rock show, the Fab 50, the movie show, the Beatbox 2 TV, Number 1, The Last Broadcast, and so on and so on. I went to 2FM Studios in Dublin to talk to Dave Fanning. On thecuriousbroadcast.com, I'm joined now by international mega hero Dave Fanning.
Hey, Ray, how are you?
I'm not so bad. Thanks a million for coming on, first
you're
of all.
You're very welcome, Ray.
Now, Dave, you're an interviewing expert, of course, whereas really? Me, on the other hand, I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants here. Like you can see, I have a couple of notes written on the back of an envelope. And we're going to see what the crack is. So we're going to talk about music broadcasting and your career for the last...
Music broadcasting, yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely, sure, that's your bread and butter.
It is.
Now, Dave, you're a bit of a Paolo Maldini, if you know what I mean.
Well, I know what you mean in that I would be very respectful of his wonderful soccer-playing skills, but I'm not 100% sure where that fits in with what I do.
Well, Paolo Maldini famously played for one club all his career, and you've been at 2FM since the outset.
Yeah, that's after Radio Dublin and Big D Radio.
Absolutely, and that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the early days. So yeah. We'll start at the very start. Radio Dublin and Big D.
Yeah.
Pirate Radio. What a life.
It was great, yeah. And like, you know, I didn't know what I was necessarily doing, but I know that's what I wanted to do, and the opportunity presented itself, so I did it. Simple as that.
Yeah, but tell us about the studios and stuff like that. And of course, like, I mean, it was a pretty different setup at the time. Like, Pirate Radio was a lot different.
What happened with me was I left college, and I was the youngest of six in a family. And basically, I was allowed a lot more time to do nothing and follow my dream more than the other five were. Let's put it that way. Right. So I came at a very good, like, the parents kind of gave up at that stage. I go on, do whatever you want to do. So I had a full year coming back from a factory in Germany, working there for the last time, realising, okay, finishing college, I better go out and get a job now, and I really don't want to have to do this. And the only job I wanted to do was something to do with radio, something to do with music, actually, to be honest. I used to buy a magazine called Scene Magazine. And one day there was an ad in the back of the Irish Times saying a Scene magazine editor wanted. I didn't see it. Three people rang me. Well, no, my mother didn't ring me. She told me about it. And two of my friends rang me and said, see what the other magazine you buy, blah, 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 looking for an editor. Yeah, well, I couldn't do that. But anyway, I went along to get the job or to see if I could work for it in Portobello in Rathmines. And I was interviewed, if that's the right word for it. Only two people went for it. And the two of us got the job. So I became the kind of music expert editor. And the other guy called Ken Ryan, who later went on to be a Fianna Fáil press officer, was the other guy. And he just was kind of a chancer doing anything. And he was great. Just, he pushed forward. There were four magazines. I don't know if you need to know all this, but anyway, there were four magazines in this stable. There was Yachts and Yachting, or Boats and Boating, or People Out Late at Night with Dickie Bowes kind of magazine, you know, the precursor of VIP and all this. And then there was this rock thing. And the guys who did it, believe it or not, the guy's name, I'll never forget it. You know what his name was? Norman Barry. Because at the time he used to watch Film 90, whatever it was, or Film 70, and that was Barry Norman. Anyway, Norman Barry owned all these things. And he said, listen, you two guys do it, because I know nothing about music. So basically I knew all about music, and I did all that bit. And suddenly we brought out 12 magazines of a good 120 pages glossy magazine every month. I was very proud of the fact that I hadn't a clue what I was doing, and going to gigs and reviewing the gigs and all the rest of it. And one of the things is, this guy came in one day called the Captain, and he said, he put his briefcase down on the table. I didn't know it was a James Bond briefcase. There was a bloody microphone in it. And he says, look, that magazine of yours, Scene Magazine, it's good, it's out there. We'd like some publicity for our radio station. I said, what radio station? He said, Radio Dublin. I said, never heard of it. And there wasn't any Radio Dublin. It was broadcasting for 2 hours on a Wednesday night. No, on a Saturday night, and that was it. But he was going to broadcast more a Wednesday. So I said, OK, we will, on one condition, that if we can do push our magazine, we'll do a programme for you, and we'll give you the free page ad that you want in the magazine. So to cut a long story short, we used to go up on a Wednesday night, myself and Ken, to a terraced house in Inchicore for about a year. And Ken was married with three kids, couldn't stay there all the time, so I had to go on air. And I basically went on air to plug the magazine, scared out of my tiny mind going on air. First track I ever played was Wishing Well by Free, and he kept coming in and asking me to play things by Boney M and this, that and the other, and putting in pop music. I said, you don't get it. So eventually some of the guys, there was a bit more programming happened, and one of the guys who was there decided to start a new station called Big D. And I joined Big D, and I had a midnight programme from midnight till 4 o'clock in the morning, maybe with Smiley.
The hours are kind of bizarre on these old pirate stations.
I've often done midnight, late o'clock. Smiley used to come in about 4 o'clock. And we really had a thing going in Dublin. And then, like, magazine Hot Press was well up by that stage. and you start getting number one in the DJ thing, and you go, what? You know, John Peel would be number two, and you go, so the people are listening. So it really started building up, because there was nothing else in Dublin like that at the time, nothing. And obviously no internet or no other distractions. And also your average household did not have two and three televisions in it like they do now. Maybe every second house had one kind of thing, you know. So it was a big deal at the time. Then all the bands started coming towards us. We went to all the bands and generally just playing demo tapes, and that's how it all happened. Then 2FM, which may or may not have happened by May, the mid-80s or the late-80s, suddenly RT said, we better start now. This pirate thing is getting out of hand. So they started in 79, and right time, right place. That's all it was. The yeah. only reason I got a gig to where I am now is because I was in the right place.
Is because you were actually part yeah. of the creation of the infrastructure. Like.
Yeah, but like it was also like, let's keep them well away at night. So I did 5 years here at midnight. And like at midnight in those days, and this is a strange thing because I don't have any statistics to back it up, is very different than it is now, because I genuinely believe that 11 o'clock at night now is kind of the new 1 o'clock. In other words, people stayed up later a lot of years ago. Certainly students were rolling something at 1 in the morning that they're not doing now because they're in bed by 11:30.
And you're giving out about it then?
Wimps, the lot of them. So there was a thing after midnight. Like now after midnight, you could count listeners on your hand, you know.
Yeah.
In those days, you could sizably get something. But then again, there was nothing else either. You know?
Yeah, and were you feeling the heat in the days of the pirates? No. You know,
oh,
you
yeah,
weren't worried about cops or anything.
Funny you should say that. I did go to the Reading Festival once, and the very night I went, we were raided in Big D, big steel door, and the door had been left open or something, and the place was raided, and it was really quite bad. There's a couple of books about it, fantastic pictures of Dennis Murray standing there looking over all the equipment. Also, in Big D, the equipment burned down one night, and that was one of the most strangest things, because they started up again 4 days later in a new place. We were in Parnell Square at that time, and we moved into Stephen's Green. And all the equipment that burnt down 4 days ago was the same equipment I was using 4 days later.
Amazing. It was still bought in the same shop.
Very weird going on. But like, I had no involvement in radio other than just leave me alone to play the music, and I never wanted any of the bosses around. And luckily, they stayed well out of the way. And it gave them a certain sort of, not cred or kudos, but something, street something. And like, that's when the U2s and that started coming up every night and that kind of thing as well. You know?
Yeah.
So it was all kind of, they didn't know anything was happening. I didn't know anything was happening.
Yeah. And of course, that like exactly you said, bands started coming in, bands started interacting, yeah. and you would like, I mean, you like you didn't have any journalism qualifications and stuff like that. You were flying by the seat of your pants,
completely. And like I had done, if journalism is the right word for it, and I had studied English in college and all that kind of thing, but I had done the Scene magazine, but I had no qualifications to do anything, and I had no right to be doing anything. It was a bit like a lot of people though who went to work for the Independent or the Times or any of those kind of things. You do the Anglo Celt or the Anglo Celt, whichever you like to call it, first, or you do some of the Mullingar Times or something, and you spend your 5 years there. Those days are all gone now. All you do now is blog. You can have something else, you know. But that's the kind of thing you did. So I had served a certain apprenticeship, but not really, no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. And like, and of course, I was reading your book, of course, and I was just read about this the time that the Ramones came into the studio. Now, when I was interviewing you, Dave, I was just like, or when I was getting ready to interview you, when I was writing down a couple of notes on the back of this envelope, I was kind of thinking, God, the only thing I want to say to Dave is, what were the Ramones like? Yeah. What was Joe Strummer like?
I can understand all that, yeah, absolutely. And I do, I think you're 100% correct, and I'd be the exact same. Funny thing about the Ramones, and funny thing about the book, the one thing about the book that annoys me is the crowd in London who did it were looking for, like little captions for
blurbs,
each of the pictures.
Yeah.
And I didn't give them one for about two of them, I forgot. So they put it in, and it just, the blurb they put in for the Ramones, the picture of me and the Ramones, really annoys me. It says, one of my favourite punk bands of all time. They're not one of my favourite punk bands of all time. That's like something my mother would say. One of my favourite bands of all time, you fool. And to stand there, to have the Ramones, the four of them in this studio in front of me, I'm glad to see somebody else gets it. Because it was just like, they're not the most intelligent, well-read people in the whole world. In fact,
yeah.
if anything, they're known for being as thick as a plank. But they're so the essence. In fact, I'll tell you a really funny thing is that when I was listening to rock and roll and all the time in the early 70s and all the rest of it, and then music was getting out of hand with Elton John and Rod Stewart playing to 90,000 people and people didn't know what was going on, and then punk came along to give it a kick in the ass, the Ramones was the one, and not the first album. I didn't hear the first album properly. That was like early 76, but by late 76 they brought out the second album, which is still in my top five favourite albums of all time, The Ramones Leave Home. And it was that album that brought me right through to the whole punk thing, saying out with the old order, in with the new. By the way, when I say out with the old order, I don't mean it in a John Peel way. I still loved everything from Dylan to Pink Floyd, etc. But just, it was great to have something new. And yeah. that Ramones' second album, and then they kept releasing better and better albums to less and less people. A bit like the Undertones, the better they got, the less people wanted to know, which is always quite sad. But it shows they were able to grow up. But the Ramones, to have the four of them here just talking, was one of the most just fantastic things I can possibly imagine.
Yeah, really, and you know, like, I remember Joe Strummer, he used to do, you know, that show London Calling on the BBC World Service, and you know everything is drama with Joe, like, you know what I mean, I remember him coming on and he said, "This is London Calling, kicking off with the High Kings of Hard Rock, the Ramones." And that's how he described them, the High Kings of Hard Rock.
But they are. And they're not really hard. I wouldn't necessarily... Fast rock, not necessarily hard rock. I think Black Sabbath might have something to say about that. But and Joe Strummer was great. He was in here a couple of times. And also I interviewed him at the Olympia one night about a year before he died. And he was fantastic. You know, in fact, I've often been asked what's the best gig I've ever seen. And without a doubt now, it's a block of flats these days. It's terrible. It wasn't in some exotic place around the world. It was in Top Hat in Dunleary. And it was the Clash on the London Calling tour, not the Clash on the previous one, which I'd seen at Trinity College, and was raved about everywhere. I thought it was one of the worst gigs I ever saw.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, I'm always humbled when I meet people who have seen the Clash live. No, but listen to me. Like, me personally, you know, I find it really difficult. You know, this might be a bit of a paradox or a juxtaposition, but I find it actually difficult to write about music or to even, like, talk about music at length. Do you know what I mean? Like, but did you ever feel intimidated or feel tested out by interviewing somebody, or did you ever say, like, I just actually don't know what to ask this person, or, or how to approach an interview?
No, because one thing about interviews, like, I've interviewed, like, I've got 200 at home of fully finished programmes of the biggest stars you can imagine, from Beach Boys to Stones to Beatles, etc. And do your homework, that's all. Simple.
Yeah.
Not a problem. And if you never rely on the questions you have in front of you, it's still nice if you have a gammy leg to have, a walking stick, if you like. You mightn't use the walking stick, but it's nice to know it's there. So if something's going wrong, you just ask the next question.
Yeah.
And I could think of everything that's gone wrong with every interview at some stage. But when you have the cameras rolling and you're 40 floors up somewhere, and the guy, you realise the cameraman doesn't have the battery that he's going to need for more than 40 minutes, and is going to have to go down to his stupid van because he stupidly forgot to bring up the stupid battery, you realise you've got one shot at it. Once it starts, it starts. And also the star comes in, and they don't want to hang around. You set up for 3 hours, you take down for an hour, and the interview is 45 minutes. And if you don't get it right, that's your own fault. So you can't have gaps, you can't have stops, and there's no need to once you have a bunch of questions. And once you also don't use the questions half the time. If they say something, you go with it and you take it there. And you don't just stop and say, I want to know this, this and this and this. You don't. You want to let them dictate it, and there's nothing wrong with that. And that's the way I like to do it.
Absolutely.
And you can make mistakes. David Byrne would be one of my heroes from Talking Heads. I've interviewed him 4 or 5 times. And the fifth time I interviewed him, I finally kind of got it right. I didn't know I don't know which one it is, OCD or Asperger's or one of those things. I didn't necessarily know it was as acute as it turned out to be. And he has this thing where he doesn't answer the question immediately. He waits about 3 seconds. And I stupidly, the first few times, asked him a question. Okay, he's not answering that. I asked him about 16 questions, and he finally answered the 16th. And I had lost 15 questions, kind of thing, you know. Because I was trying to help him out, because I don't like silence.
Yeah.
And it was stupid, you know. And he scratches his sock, and he does this, that, and the other. And then, when he gets to know you too, he knows the thing. And he's very cool.
I think I remember something similar happening when you were asking Tom Waits a question on the phone.
Tom Waits was hilarious.
I think he asked you, had you had too much coffee?
He did.
And because he was thinking about the first question you asked, but did about 4 or 5 follow while he was thinking about
it. No, he did. He answered every single question the same way. He says, gee, I don't know, Dave. And I go, wow, are you a psychiatrist? Like, these questions, holy, I wish I was sitting down. Like, you know, how much is it, $200 an hour? And he was great. But he was Tom Waits. By the way, Tom Waits was on Letterman the other night on TV. He performed a song from the new album. So I believe, and I'm sure it can be seen on the old interweb.
Absolutely.
Which I wouldn't mind taking a look at. I didn't know he was on at all.
Great stuff.
But yeah.
Some operator.
Yeah.
And of course, talking about setting up interviews and stuff like that, it went one step further when 2FM was rocking the Fanning Sessions.
Yeah.
And like, you mentioned that the Fanning Sessions was part of your public service remit.
Well, the thing about 2FM when it started was that Ian Wilson, fiery Ian Wilson, on the very first day of 2FM, there was an interview of me in the Irish Times, a half-page interview, and it went on about blah, 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 and it says, his producer is well-known radical about town, Ian Wilson. And Ian had been in jail for occupying the Department of Education and for being on the steps of Trinity, ranting and raving through bullhorns.
Fiery, people is
not, yeah, not to pay your fees and all this kind of stuff, etc. And he was well-known for all this kind of thing. And he came to RT with that same zeal, if you like, and realised he got to do a few things. Now, what I had done on Pirate Radio a lot was play demo tapes. I just got into it. I kind of fell into it more than anything. It never had occurred. Well, nothing had occurred to me about doing whatever I was going to radio. So, like, I go to see all the bands and the Baggot and all these kind of places, and I take their demos and play them. And this wasn't like singles they released or anything like that. This was just demo tapes, etc. And the band I played most on demo just happened to be that time was U2. Not that I thought they were the best, I didn't, but just that was the band I played most. So there was studios here in RT that were being used for things like proper things for Irish Times readers, like the Irish, you know, Concert Orchestra and stuff like that, or the RT one, and all these kind of things, and plays and Thomas Davis lectures and stuff. And Wilson quite rightly said, look, we should be doing something else. And suddenly, very quickly, somebody in 2FM could see that a public service remit could be served on 2FM by bringing in bands all the time. In other words, losing money, if you like, because you bring a band in, you spend 2 days in the studio with the sound man and all the rest of it, and use the equipment and use the facilities, and then they go off. And the bands all loved it because it was the first rung up the ladder. The bands all loved it because they could give it to a record company, even though they shouldn't have, in terms of, like, you know, this is our thing. And they also, you know, they didn't get an awful lot of time, but they were able to get all the music down on a Monday and do the vocals on a Tuesday, and that was enough. And have your four numbers together before you go. And those four numbers would be played twice a month, every month. Twice, like, you know, for a full night, one night, and then once again sometime. And, like, at a time when 2FM was the only national thing going and there wasn't that much distractions like internet, that was a really big deal. So yeah. It was great. It was fantastic for everybody. Yeah. So, we did that, and Ian was the one. I was only on contract, as I still am, so you don't have enough clout in terms of management. They don't listen to you. So Ian did, because he was the producer, and he went up and broke down the door and said, we need to do this. Don't worry, we're not looking for Studio One. We don't want your big studio. Studio 8 will do. And Studio 8, 30 years later or 40 years later, with at least 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 hundred bands who've gone through it all, including all the greats, the Cranberries and all that, etc., when they were just the Cranberry Sauce, and bands that went on to sell millions. It was never about going on to sell millions, by the way. Like, if the band broke up at Christmas, tough, we don't care. We're not the mother of the guitarist or something.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it doesn't matter to us, you know, just as long as we got a good session. Yeah. And that's what it was all about. And there was a service there.
Yeah. And of course, you mentioned there that you were the only national music station at the time.
Yeah, so it was easy for us to get it right.
Get a captive audience.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, just don't get it wrong. I always think in those days of the sort of superstar DJs by default, which is what we were, Jerry Ryan and all the rest of it, all you got to do is don't mess up. And I thought we were pretty good. I'm sure we weren't great, but we were good enough. We were as good as the next person would ever have been if they had got the gig.
Good at not messing up.
And we were the good, we were the lucky ones to have got it, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, you mentioned there U2. There's an element of kind of hilarity when I look at pictures of you two and yourself and stuff like that, because it crosses the world between the madness of it all and you two coming out in Mexico City in front of 200,000 people going absolutely bonkers, and then coming back to Dublin.
Oh yeah.
And you hooking up and you going for a pint or something like that, and it just being a regular situation. And yeah, so do you think, you know, it's a pretty hilarious situation to look at?
Yeah, I mean, I am surprised at how, if I use the word unaffected, I suppose I'd have to use inverted commas, how unaffected they seem to be and how capable they are of being normal, because I wouldn't be. And I don't know anybody else that would be. I don't get how they are as normal as they are. I mean, I remember once in Modena in Italy, I was doing a TV documentary on U2's Joshua Tree tour. This would be 87. And we were there, and I remember talking to Adam Clayton. He just said, like, you know, it is just impossible to just take each day with the madness that each day seems to offer, you know, just of the next level all the time. And for him, it was the easiest of all. And yet, it was just the total and absolute madness. And that was, like, you know, that's nearly 30 years ago. Is it 30 years or something? 25 years ago. So, like, you know, it got bigger and bigger as it went along, too. So it's all completely and absolutely insane. So they would need to, you know,
it's amazing what you can get used to.
Normal here, I'm bloody sure. I not that I particularly would necessarily want it. I wouldn't mind the money. I don't particularly want all the fame and like that, you know, to do without it.
To be a bit hectic.
But yeah, it is all mad, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But listen, around what stage, like, you were doing a couple of, like, TV gigs and stuff like that during the 80s. But yeah. Then, of course, broadcasting music on TV, that was in the 90s, I suppose, was it?
Well, it was everything. There was all sorts of TV gigs. I mean, for 25 years, I did something each year. I mean, there was the number one pop quiz, which was absolutely huge, actually. It was supposed to go for 1 year, then I went for 5. Jerry Ryan was the other team captain. They were really mad days now, I can tell you. Then Jerry gave it up to do something, and Joe Elliott took over, and he was number one in America, having knocked Thriller off the top of the charts with his Def Leppard band and all that. And it was all just crazy carry on, like, really crazy. You know?
Yeah, like that's a slightly early memory for me. Like, is Joe Elliott, Def Leppard? Because I used to have the old Def Leppard patches sewn into the old denim jacket, you know. Yeah. And so yeah, he was number one in America, and he was spoofing with the boys in Dublin.
He was spoofing with the boys here in Dublin, yeah, because he loves all that stuff. He's really into rock and roll trivia and all that, and you should see his record collections and his collections of old sort of programs from gigs he went to as a kid in Sheffield Guildhall and all those kind of places. So it's huge, you know. I mean, like, it's just, but it was madness at that time because I was also doing. What was it, Channel 4, I was doing 3 years of live TV stuff there, and that was crazy. That brought me all over England live at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night, or to America. I did a JJ Cale one live at a hot 5 o'clock in the afternoon in Boston when I was 11 o'clock at night in England. And then there was Richard Branson rang me up to ask me to do Virgin Radio, so I did that for a few years. That's what I was still doing this year, and I was doing the movie show, and I was doing two rock shows on TV. So there was a lot going on in the 90s more than any other time. Yeah.
Flat out, yeah. I didn't notice you were with Virgin Radio for a while.
It was in the first 2 years I was doing Saturday afternoon. The guy called Chris Evans, who was very famous nowadays. In fact, he was pretty famous then because he was doing the breakfast thing, and he went on to, he was in a program called The Big Red Mug, which was sponsored by Maxwell House, get it? And he's got a big red mug, and he was on from 10 till 12, and I'd be on from 4 till 8. And well, I used to meet him in the canteen all the time in the afternoon over there in Virgin, number one Golden Square. In fact, I think it's still number one Golden Square. And that was the first few years, yeah. And I gave that up because I just wanted to do 2 years. It was just getting a bit too mad. Because then I was doing two TV on the Sunday morning, so I had to make sure I got home on the Saturday night to do Sunday morning live. And that lasted for 6 years. Two hours live on a Sunday morning, playing Boyzone and that, which I loved doing. That was really funny.
Well, Dave, in all fairness, no, it was the beatbox and two TV, like you say, but there was kind of, you know, you had your own stamp on it as well. Like, I remember, well, like, Mercury Revno and stuff like that showing up.
The thing about
all
that was, like, the students laughed at it because I slagged everything, and then the kids liked it because they got the music. And that was in the days when people would look to RTÉ and television to get music. You know, those days are kind of completely gone now, you know. I still think they should have something on a Sunday morning between 10 and 12. I bet you nobody listening right now could tell you what's on Sunday morning 10 to 12 on RTÉ1 or RTÉ2 television for the last 10 years. I haven't got a clue.
Cartoons, I'd say.
I'd say so too. And Mass.
I don't know. I couldn't tell you if Mass is still going out. Yeah. But, like, I mean, there's an interesting point there, you say, like, where people turn to their music now, like, you know what I mean? And, of course, the game has changed immeasurably since the early days and stuff like that, like, you know what I mean? And we've seen, like, if you look at even independent radio schedules now, like, a lot of alternative music schedules are really being pushed to the edge. And, it's an interesting time, I think, you know what I mean? Especially for, let's say, alternative music broadcasters.
Well, the minute you say the word broadcasting, what do you mean by broadcasting? I mean, Mr. Spring here from this parish would have a few things to say about that, I'd say.
Jump in there, Mr. Spring.
The whole thing has changed. It's just completely and absolutely changed 100% and very quickly, too, in the last 6 or 7 years. And much of what you believe to be what is music and what should be music, I don't care what anybody says, it's gone. And no matter how many musicians out there saying, no, it's a great new challenge, it's a great thing, so much of it has just changed. Certainly the broadcasting side of it, it's just dramatically changed. Yeah. Like, for instance, if I say I've got an exclusive, I don't have an exclusive. There's no such thing anymore because it's already been on the internet that afternoon or somewhere. Somebody else has the exclusive somewhere, sometime, you know. And also there's so much music. I play music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and now. Maybe it's too broad. Maybe I'm playing too much, you know. So I'm just playing music that I really like, and maybe some people can see that, and that's hopefully what it is. But does it mean as much as it used to? No, it definitely doesn't. So the minute you say the word broadcasting, narrowcasting, anything else, it's all changed. And I don't necessarily think, I'll tell you, the biggest example of the change is that people don't measure music anymore in terms of albums. Now, people could say, I'm sure Springer would guffaw at this, so what, they haven't done since Dance Fit the Big Time in 1990. But seriously, that means a lot to me. I like a body of work to come out from somebody. A Neil Young, perfect example, is an album at the moment called Americana, which is absolutely awful. But it doesn't really matter. It's his 40th album or so. I love Neil Young, and I go with Neil Young wherever he goes, and I'll check it out. And I like, it's like his latest exhibition of work if he was a sculptor or something like that. You see it all. That's number 9 there, which isn't as good as the third one here. I want a full album. I want to be able to turn the album over and say, second last track inside 2, have you heard it? It's fantastic, kind of thing. And if that's a throwback to a day that's now gone, then so be it. I don't particularly like music being measured in just plucking a song here and there, whichever one suits you. And also the ease of which people get music these days, I think, has taken away from it. Basically, music has lost the value that it used to have. It just has. I don't care what anybody says. And it's narrowed down. Say whatever you like, Springer. Shout it.
Springer, jump in there.
Shout it.
Value. I broke the mic.
There is
value
no,
is the word.
There's no value anymore. People don't... I think there's no journey anymore. People don't go to bargain bins. Like, I used to go in and say, oh, the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus. Gotta buy that, even for the time. Look at that album cover there. I know I'm sort of sounding like Granny in the feckin' armchair with the Horlicks and the slippers. But seriously, there is a question that once the journey's been taken away and there is no journey anymore, yeah, it's just gone.
Value and longevity. We used to say that when we did the review show that got us into loads of trouble.
We did get into loads of trouble.
My number one slag on things, and well, this music has no value, and there was all that bad rap music that was flooding in at the time. And to me, it had no value. And well, how can you question the value of music? Isn't that that's subjective, surely? No, it isn't. This music was instant. It's a clone. It's nonsense. It's got a life of maybe 3 weeks. It's pointless. You know, why waste everybody's time manufacturing this? Why don't you, it's a waste of electricity. What is it you're hoping for?
Yeah.
More bling. It had no value then. And I was right. I'd say maybe two tunes that we reviewed in like 3 or 4 years that I can remember. And the acts are still going. And I think one of the only acts we bigged up at the time, because we knew they were kind of cute and stuff, was Girls Aloud, who've just imploded. But no, that was because we were recognising the formula was correct.
Yeah,
there were these girls.
And they did it well.
They were accessible. It was brilliantly done. They weren't too hot. You know, you might talk to them in a club. They might give you the time of day. They had this brilliant, laid out in front of them, this whole plan of how accessible they would be to the youth and to older men and so on. Right, but that's even dead now because of the freedom of dating and
okay, but listen, finally, let's not get too pessimistic about it all, and let me just quote Doris Day here and say, you know, what's the future? I don't know. Okay, sirrah, sirrah. Let's go with it.
Yeah, like, you know, it's for me, it's all about integrity, like, you know what I mean? You're treating music with integrity, you're treating artists with integrity. No, it's going to change, and the monetary value and stuff is going to change, or let's say how people interact with it in terms of, you know, like the infrastructure that we mentioned, like, you know, broadcasting and stuff like that is going to change. But as long as the integrity is there and the quality is there, do you know, there's something to go for.
If it's there.
Yeah, but this is all technology driven, though. You've got to, you're lamenting the fall of the album.
I can see you fading this down. The three of us are talking.
No, I think it's all still there.
No, you keep talking, I'll fade it down.
No, it's just.
I'm getting a signal from my producer to wind it up.
Technology has changed the way you do everything in music, from making it through to selling it and appreciating it. So I think it's the same, and I think you just need to, you know.
Well, thank you very much for your contribution.
More, I think. Thanks to the term.
Come on, Springer, and thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Dave. So
and that's it from this episode of On Key Rogue Ella on CuriousBroadcast.com. Keep it community, keep it curious, take it nice and easy, everybody. Thanks a million for listening, and slán go fóill.